Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Good morning. This morning, the court has five causes on its oral submission docket, which have been consolidated into three submissions. In the order they will be presented, they are as follows. City of El Paso, State of Texas, and Office of Public Utility Council versus the Public Utility Commission and El Paso Electric Company from Travis County, consolidated with Public Utility Commission and Central Power and Light Company versus State of Texas and Office of Public Utility Council from Travis County, consolidated with Public Utility Commission and Houston Lighting and Power Company versus State of Texas and Office of Public Utility Council from Travis County. The court has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present oral arguments and causes, and the sides have been allotted. We will then take a brief recess and come back to hear the second argument, which will be Office of Public Utility Council versus the Public Utility Commission of Texas and West Texas Utilities Company from Travis County. The court has allotted 15 minutes for each side to present arguments. We will then take a recess and hear the final argument of the morning, Public Utility Commission of Texas, State Purchasing and General Services Commission, Office of Public Utility Council, City of Abernathy and others, versus GTE Southwest Incorporated and others from Travis County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. These arguments are being tape recorded for the convenience of the court and are being stenographically recorded. If anyone wishes to listen to the tape recordings of these arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in the first consolidated cause.
May it please the court, Mr. Norman Gordon and Mr. W. Scott McCullough will present argument from petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Gordon will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Norman Gordon. I'm from El Paso. I represent the city of El Paso in this proceeding. In this case, Scott McCullough and I, Mr. McCullough representing the consumer interest of the state, state agencies in El Paso, will divide the time allotted to petitioners. In the opening portion, I will talk for 10 minutes, and Mr. McCullough will then also speak with the court for 10 minutes. The court in this case has combined for argument three cases, all of which are appeals from the decision of the Public Utility Commission of Texas, and all of which involve a device called deferred accounting. Using deferred accounting, the Public Utility Commission has attempted to allow the utilities to recover from ratepayers operating costs in return, including a profit component, or a return to equity component rather, related to new power plants that the utilities would otherwise not have been allowed to recover. During the construction of a new power plant, or for that matter, another facility that a utility may be building, a utility is allowed to capitalize all of the costs of the construction, including costs other than the brick and mortar costs, including plant carrying costs and a component for an equity return, in an allowance known as Allowance for Funds Used During Construction, sometimes referred to as AFUDC. AFUDC then becomes part of the original cost of the plant once it is placed in service. By accounting rules, AFUDC ceases, that is, it ends, and the utility's right to accumulate these carrying costs ceases as of the date the plant is placed in service, the plant is complete, or otherwise sometimes known as the date the plant achieves commercial operation. Thereafter, the return to the utility from this plant and this investment is realized through the recovery of revenues. To the extent that there is a passage of time between the completion of the plant and the date new rates go into effect from a rate case in which all of the utility's expenses, revenues, and investments are considered. The utility does not receive any special retroactive or retrospective recovery of the return and expenses related to the plant. This gap is sometimes called, and we'll define it a little bit later in this discussion, regulatory lag, and it's a natural device that is considered and contemplated by the statute and has been considered and contemplated as a part of regulation.
Mr. Gordon, let me ask a question so I'm clear on where we are. We're talking about capitalizing some post-startup costs,
Yes.
Is that, does that necessarily mean that whatever, well, the utilities want to amortize that. Does that necessarily mean it's part of the rate base? Is there a distinction between rate base upon which a return is calculated and just return, just amortization of some costs?
There are two different problems here. The one that is squarely addressed by the Court of Appeals in its decision is the capitalization of these costs, and which necessarily, when we talk about capitalization, means including them in rate base rather than just deferring this cost and somehow amortizing the cost. The specific issue that the Court of Appeals decided...
Well, now the Court of Appeals in a footnote said they weren't talking about return on the investment. They were simply talking about capitalization and amortization, weren't they?
The footnote in the Court of Appeals opinion said that the Court of Appeals was not expressing any opinion on whether or not these costs could be without a return, without being part of rate base, later amortized. That's correct.
Aren't there discussions throughout utility, the PUC orders over time that talk about a difference between amortization and return, a return of investment and a return on investment?
Differences that I'm aware of in PUC orders over time, or that I can think of now as you ask me, Your Honor, are those costs that are related to canceled plant costs. In cases, oftentimes canceled plant costs, for example, the utility starts building a plant, decides it doesn't need it, and cancels the project. If those, oftentimes those costs are allowed to be recovered without a return on them, without being included in rate base. Sometimes they're not allowed to be recovered at all, and sometimes, in some cases, they've been allowed to be recovered with the return.
So the purposes of this hearing, the footnote in the Court of Appeals notwithstanding, but the purpose of this hearing, this court says that utilities can capitalize regulatory lag expenses, then we are in effect saying that they are entitled to a return on that money.
Yes, Your Honor. And the division in this case is that the utilities are asking that they be both allowed to capitalize those expenses and also to amortize them over time. And if you allow them to capitalize them, there's no doubt they're allowed to collect them from ratepayers with the return.
Okay. And while all that sounds rather arcane, we are talking about really literally billions of dollars. Not, of course, in your case, just hundreds of millions, but billions of dollars that would be affected by how this court interprets the statute and its application to deferred accounting treatment.
Quite frankly, Your Honor, I don't know if the number goes up to billions, but it's certainly in the hundreds of millions of dollars that have occurred in these cases that are before you, involving these four utilities that you'll hear this morning, both the three that are in this consolidated argument and the next case that you will hear.
From the utility company and the utility investor standpoint, how can we expect to have the utility service we need to meet the growth if the investors have to absorb all of that expenditure?
The issue is, as we believe, Your Honor, is what does the statute require and what does the statute allow? And that relates to the regulatory lag issue. It's our position, and we believe the statute is fairly clear, that the statute contemplates some degree of regulatory lag. In that, the statute contemplates that we use an historical test year in Texas as opposed to a projected test year. The statute contemplates that there will be at least a 35-day period once you file your rate increase request until the rates could be rate increase could be granted, and the statute also contemplates that there could be a suspension period of up to 150 days at the PUC, 90 days at the municipal level on any rate increases. Those are all things that the legislature had in mind when it passed the statute, but there should be some degree of regulatory law. That, on the other side of that.
Requiring that they use a historical test year is just to remove one element of uncertainty and take some of the guesswork out of it, wasn't it?
The discussions between using different types of test years, whether they're historical test years or whether they are projected test years, is different ways of dealing with the problem of arriving at what the right values are, or what the right plant amounts are, what the right expenses are. There's always some degree of, if you've ever tried any of these cases, there's always a degree of uncertainty as to what things actually have been. I don't think it changes very much whether you use one type of test year or another.
Well, you can guess what's going to happen, or you can look back and see what has happened.
Well, but when you look back and see what has happened, you're saying when we look back and see what has happened and we adjust that for what the commission talks about as known and measurable changes, you're really still making a guess or an estimate as to whether that same circumstance will apply in the future. So it's just two different ways of looking at the same point in our view, Your Honor.
What advantage does this view, the use of deferred accounting treatment, offer the utility over the alternatives referenced in the statute?
Well, the alternatives referenced in the statute are several things that the utility can do to alleviate the problem of regulatory lag, but the legislature also, we believe, specifically contemplated. That included the inclusion of construction work in progress in rate base. That is a current return on your construction costs in cash provided to the utility. The prompt filing of rate cases, the utility can file a rate case when it chooses. The ability to get interim rates if the utility's financial condition requires, and the statute leaves that pretty much in the discretion of the commission as to when it can put into effect interim rates, and also the ability to place rates into effect under bond, which the utility can do at 185 days after it files its case at the PUC. Those are the alternatives to contemplate and imply and let the management do what it needs to do and give the commission an opportunity on an ongoing basis to evaluate the situation as it needs to be evaluated for appropriate relief to the utility.
And so in answer to the question, how can investors be expected to bear all of these costs, your answer is that under the statute they don't have to, there are other alternatives?
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely the case. For example, in the El Paso case, the city of El Paso, the El Paso Electric case, the utility waited a considerable length of time before filing its case. It waited over 1 year until after Palo Verde Unit 1 had achieved commercial operation to file the case, and it also did not try to bond rates or ask for interim rates at the commission. So whatever the gap period is here, it could have been alleviated in large part by the utility.
Mr. Gordon, are you saying that, well, are you saying if these expenses are deferred and they're allowed to amortize them, and I'm not talking about the rate base, is this some sort of double recovery they're getting, or you're simply, in an answer to Judge Heck's question, you're saying there are some interim things they could have done to recover some of these costs? You're just saying that this is not the mechanism to do that.
That's correct. We have not identified a double recovery. The other issue is the retroactive issue, and that in large part is the issue that Mr. McCullough is going to address before you this morning, and he is going to take the rest of our opening time.
May it please the Court. My name is Scott McCullough. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I'm representing the state of Texas in its consumer interest of utility services. In the cases before the court today, the commission was faced with a significant change in utilities' costs of operation that were not considered when rates were last established. It faced an extended regulatory lag period, which it determined to constitute an unreasonable burden or benefit. So the commission identified an amount, created a fund, and required payment of that fund over a period of years. The essential nature of the relief that was granted in the deferral cases and in the GTE case, which we're going to hear later, was the same. Relation back of effective rates and the effective date of a rate order and deferral forward of cost recognition are merely two sides of the same coin. These cases are technical, very complicated, both in terms of the concepts and the procedure, but the problem that the commission faced and the relief that it granted was the same. The cases that we have presented to the court, the law review article, and the arguments that we have presented in our brief basically suggest seven policy principles that we think the court should establish for purposes of resolving all of these cases. One, retroactive rate making is to be discouraged, but sometimes it's necessary. Indeed, sometimes it's required. Whatever retroactive rate making is used, it must be balanced. Neither side should always win or always lose, always get the gain and never suffer the losses. The commission must consider the legitimate expectations of the stakeholders. For example, was there notice that a retroactive remedy would be applied? The commission must consider all of the benefits and all of the burdens flowing from the lag period. The commission must consider whether there are existing remedies which are adequate to protect either the utility or the ratepayer interests involved.
Why do you say that this is, I mean, to me the concept of retroactive is that I've been paying my electric bill for the last 6 months and then all of a sudden I get a surcharge on it, on my bill, because I didn't pay enough for the last 6 months. How does calculating what the rate starting today and on into the future for what the what you're going to pay for your electric bill mean it's retroactive?
In the deferred accounting cases, the essence of the utility's argument is that the rates during the lag period were inadequate. They were not high enough. And so what they were trying to do was defer forward these increased costs so that when amortization began, not only were ratepayers paying for the prospective costs of operation, but also recovering these unrecognized costs during the regulatory lag period. And so the Court of Appeals, for example, said that when the new plant came online, that the rates in effect did not reflect the new implied contract between the ratepayers and the utility that was caused by the additional plant costs. But consider the same thing in GTE, for example. What the Court of Appeals did not recognize in GTE was that there were materially reduced costs which were not recognized in rates during the lag period. Didn't that, too, cause a new implied contract justifying retroactive remedy? The relief that was granted by the Commission in all of these cases was prospective. There were surcharges or there were additional amortized costs, and ratepayers in the future will be paying them. There was no attempt to go back and identify the difference that individual ratepayers made. I hope that answers the question. Another important consideration is, does the Commission have rate-making jurisdiction over the time periods and the amounts in issue? And finally, what factors justify the Commission's exercise of discretion? How do the deferrals in these cases rank under those policy arguments? Deferred accounting is piecemeal. Only the additional plant costs are preserved for future recovery. Other reduced costs are not recognized. For example, like the tax reductions that were identified in GTE. Those were ignored and are therefore lost. In HL&P and CPL's case, they weren't even rate cases. These were accounting cases. So the Commission had no rate-making jurisdiction. For El Paso Electric, although the deferred accounting authority was granted in a rate-making case, there were still periods of time over which the Commission did not have rate-making jurisdiction. And finally, for deferred accounting, the Commission gave relief for the entire lag period. The utilities were completely immunized from any amount of regulatory lag, despite the legislature's conscious efforts to give remedies to ameliorate regulatory lag harm.
Mr. McCullough, if the PUC grants the authority to defer the accounting on, defer these expenses accounting, is that tantamount to including in the rate base?
In the deferred accounting orders before the court today, the Commission promised that all deferred amounts found to be reasonably incurred, not reasonable to recover, but reasonably incurred, would be recovered and would be put in rate base.
Okay,
it was a promise of recovery.
But that's an issue on whether or not that promise was correct. But are you challenging their authority to permit deferred accounting?
In the HL&P and CPL cases, we are, because we contend that what the Commission was doing was rate-making in a non-rate-making case. We contend that the Commission does not have the authority to, in effect, create an asset or a debt on the ratepayers in a non-rate-making case.
So I understand that you're not saying that the PUC does not have the authority to implement deferred accounting. You're just saying that if there's savings to the ratepayers to be calculated, that those ought to be taken into account along with any expenses incurred by the utility during regulatory lag. Is that correct?
Very much so. Now, of course, there still is the 41A issue, but in concept, that's exactly correct. It must be balanced. We must capture both the additional cost and the reduced cost.
Well, if the statute does not prohibit deferred accounting, then why should a court tinker with what's essentially a bookkeeping method implemented by the agency? Is that our function upon judicial review of an administrative agency order?
In the HLMP and CPO cases, one of the things that the state recommended to the commission was that the utilities be allowed to book these amounts and later seek recovery of them. Utilities opposed that, and the commission found that it could not do so because of the accounting rules, which require a promise of recovery. The essential piece here in these deferred accounting cases is the promise of recovery, the obligation that is formed on behalf of the ratepayers by the commission. We submit that's rate action, and it cannot be taken in a non-rate-making case.
Well, as I hear your argument at this point, it is that regulatory lag is a problem. This may be a solution, but the way it was conducted here isn't fair. Is that?
It is not fair, and it was without authority because the relief that was granted was covered periods of time over which the commission did not have rate-making jurisdiction.
But in some of the cases, do you agree that if you could have attacked the carrying costs or other costs on the basis of whether they should be allowed in the rate base, it might have been that the deferred accounting treatment was okay? If you could have litigated that issue?
We would have liked very much to litigate that issue. We do have a particular problem with the granting of a return, a rate-making action, by the way, in a non-rate-making case, where the utility is allowed to book a return on its plan investment, plus earn carrying costs on the entire deferred expense plus return balance.
But your position is deferred accounting may be appropriate in some circumstances, but procedurally, these are not those circumstances.
Very much so, yes.
Well, is it your position that the statute provides the exclusive remedy for this problem of regulatory lag and that deferred accounting treatment is not one of the remedies provided?
I believe that the relief that was granted using the method of deferred accounting is not allowed under the statute because there were more than adequate statutory remedies. Assuming the commission had authority to grant the essential relief here, we don't necessarily have a problem with the accounting method that was used.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Harry Reisner, Ms. Norma Scoggin, and Mr. Robert Herring will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Reisner will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. I will speak for CPNL in El Paso and deal generally with the basic concept of deferred accounting as applied here. Ms. Scoggin will follow for the commission, dealing with the accounting rules, the commission's discretion, and the constitutional obligations of the commission under these circumstances. Mr. Herring will close dealing with the Court of Appeals opinion and a further analysis of deferred accounting.
As you begin, Mr. Reisner, do you agree with Mr. Gordon that for the PUC to allow capitalization, deferral and capitalization of, the deferral of these expenses is tantamount to capitalizing them and entitling the utility companies to a return not of the investment, but on the investment?
Your Honor, I agree to this extent. The Commission created these deferred accounts and allowed us to capture the expenses. Mr. McCullough is in error in saying that there's any promise that we would be allowed to put them in rate base. The Commission's orders make very clear that the Commission has full power to judge whether these expenses were reasonable, prudent, whether they're used and useful. It can disallow the entire amount. They are under no obligation in that rate case to permit them. It is correct that if we satisfy rate case criteria, that we would then be given a return on that deferred amount. And that is a vital point, Your Honor. What is at stake here for CP&L alone is $270 million of real costs. Nobody disputes the reality of those costs. They are very real costs. If we can prove that they were reasonably expended and they're given a return, then we will only be made whole. If we are not given a return, we would either lose $270 million entirely, or if we were merely, which I would say would, in my opinion, be unconstitutional and would be devastating to the company. But in addition, if we were permitted to amortize, the distinction Your Honor was pointing to where we got a return of the investment, but not a return on the investment, the present value of that $270 million amortized over 38 years is only $60 million. So we would be taking a $210 million hit.
Once the commission chooses to create the asset account, what basis would there be for them excluding it from the rate base at a later proceeding?
There would be, Your Honor, all of the tests that the commission uses in any rate base. They could determine it was unreasonable. They could determine it was excessive. They could determine that, you know,
would they treat it like construction work in progress?
As far as putting it into the rate base?
Yes. Would the utility have to make the type of showing that it has to make under the statute for the exclusion of work in progress in order to have it included in the rate base?
Prior, Your Honor. If we were getting construction work in progress as an emergency measure because of getting cash before we put the plan into rate base?
I guess at any point. The statute sets up a standard. It refers to the inclusion of construction work in progress as being extraordinary. Is there any extraordinary showing that the utility has to make in order to include this deferred accounting?
There is. Thank you, Your Honor. There is, Your Honor, and that is the distinction that Mr. McCullough mentions between retroactive rate making and what is involved here. I think it is critical for the court to recognize that all that is involved today before the court is how you treat the addition of massive new utility plants into the system. And the commission expressly found that they would permit deferred accounting only because the failure to do so would jeopardize the financial integrity of the company. So we're not involved in any general retroactive rate making. We're talking about how do you deal with adding new plants to the system.
Wasn't the standard, though, that was applied by the commission a different one than that required for the inclusion of construction work in progress?
I would say not, Your Honor, in that both would jeopardize the financial integrity. It's a difference in degree. If you get construction work in progress before the plant's completed, you have to show that you need cash to survive. Here, the utilities made no showing that they needed cash to survive, but merely made the showing if you penalize them for hundreds of millions of dollars and never allowed them to recover it and never allowed them to get a return on it, it would jeopardize their financial integrity.
Well, did they make any showing that that the inclusion of the account was necessary to the financial integrity of the utility?
They did. The commission so found.
And with reference to the West Texas Utilities case, I know we'll get to that one next, but there apparently the utility was already earning 18% on return on its capital. How do we know that the utility was not already earning enough to be able to absorb these costs?
Well, Your Honor, first, we haven't had the rate case in CP&L and HRC. In El Paso, we know that because there's substantial evidence supporting the inclusion of it in the rates. If there was a different standard applied in West Texas Utilities, and if I might respectfully preserve that until that time, I think that another critical factor to bear in mind is that it was the commission who insisted on this approach and created this gap between the date of commercial operation and the rate base order. And they did so for exactly the reason that Justice Hightower adverted to. That is, they said you cannot file a rate case so that you're simultaneous with the commercial operation date. El Paso tried to. They made very clear that they wanted to look at the historical operations of nuclear plants. By doing so, they created the gap between the commercial operation date and the many months and hundreds of millions of dollars in costs later before they could make the decision of whether to put it in the rate base. The Commission's approach was very sensible and sound. It's appropriate to look at something like a nuclear plant on a real historical basis. And they had no problem with that because they knew they could utilize deferred accounting, a well-accepted approach to putting new plants in rate base to capture the cost incurred in that era. Court of Appeals said, well, under FERC rules, you have to, accounting convention, you can no longer capitalize construction work in progress once you have commercial operation date. That's perfectly true. What the Court of Appeals missed is the second half of the coin. FERC accounting expressly provided. FERC expressly recognizes that the way you deal with the regulatory gap of this nature is to use deferred accounting, and that's cited at page 15 of the CP&L brief. If I could show you briefly these charts, Your Honor. First chart on recovery, and this is tab 1 in the handout that we've given you. No one can argue that the basic purpose of our statute is to permit full recovery of the cost. And if I could go to the second line here, what happened here was when we have the commercial operation date, accounting convention says that you have to switch. You can no longer use the construction work in progress account, which Justice Dahlman referred to, but you must switch to deferred accounting. If you are not permitted to switch to deferred accounting, you lose. I'm using hypothetical numbers of $5 billion here. $5 billion that cost to take that plant from the grant of the Certificate of Convenience and Necessity to the rate case. You lose $500 million. If I may go to the third. What the Commission did here was simply, just as they were capitalizing all of the expensive construction costs prior to that, they dealt with it through deferred accounting. And if I might, you'd show me the second chart, please. If we are dealing merely with, and this is tab 2, we are dealing with the same things here. While the plant is being constructed, you have plant materials and labor, but of course you have operation, maintenance costs, insurance, ad valorem taxes. You have the same thing during this deferred accounting period. So all that is involved is capturing the cost prior to putting it in the rate base.
But Mr. Reeser, you say this should only happen if the utility is about to drain.
That's the only question that is presented to this court, Your Honor. I personally would have problems with any utility regulation system that is systematically structured to deprive you of meeting the statutory purpose of a reasonable opportunity to obtain a return. In this case, Your Honor, though they found these were of such enormous magnitude that it would jeopardize the financial integrity of the utility.
There's no real principled reason to deny it for a smaller degree of harm.
I think there is, you do run into this, Your Honor, and at some point, if you, obviously you wouldn't use it for trivial expenses. Obviously, as Mr. Norm put out, if you have some increased cost, you don't get them all. I mean, there is a regulatory lag. Here, it's important to realize that there's no regulatory lag that could be covered by the statute. He said we could have filed a prompt rate case. He's entirely wrong. The Commission would not let us. Said we want to see it operate. They created this hundreds of millions of dollars gap, found that the financial integrity would be jeopardized. Here is a perfectly appropriate remedy, and I would respectfully submit that there is no legitimate basis for attacking it.
Are there not other remedies under the statute that would be available to take care of this problem?
There are not, Your Honor. As I think that Mr. Gordon's analysis demonstrated, all of those other remedies are subsequent to the filing of the rate case. Time has to pass. Here, the costs are of such enormous magnitude that if we're delayed 6 months, you're imposing an unrecoverable cost $100 million, or the numbers are hypothetical, but exposing very large costs, there is no other statutory remedy. I would respectfully suggest that this is an express statutory remedy under Section 27, which gives them the opportunity to set the form of accounts, and 39, which gives them the obligation to permit you to have a reasonable opportunity to obtain a return. This is a commission-created phenomenon. We were prevented from filing them. This gap was done so the commission could watch them operate. And having done that, the commission dealt with it in a very reasonable fashion.
Mr. Reisner, this scenario assumes that and this may be my ignorance in accounting, but it assumes that you had no recovery at all of no apportionment, let's say, of operating this plant and the cost of labor, the cost of fuel that's consumed and that sort of thing, where I guess you say you're entitled to get some sort of return on this money during this regulatory lag time and not just the return, not just coverage of the expenses. And it seems to me that doesn't somehow account for that you've actually had income coming in while it's you actually have money coming in. It's just that the return isn't as great on the operating expenses during this period of time as you would otherwise want the return to be. You want to maintain a sufficient return to attract investors to the project. That doesn't necessarily mean that you get maybe it does, but it doesn't seem to me that necessarily means that you get the same type of return on expenses that you've deferred that would otherwise not be considered capital investment. I guess, let me describe what I'm saying. If I borrow, as an investor, $100, and then I put the $100 into the electric plant dedicated to public service, I want a return of my $100, plus I want a return on that $100 of interest. I want them to pay me interest. But because I'm having to pay out interest for the money I borrowed to put in there, doesn't necessarily mean I now get a return on the interest that I paid out. I just want to make sure that whatever I get from the rates covers my cost of having borrowed the money. And that's what's causing my problem here. It seems to me if we defer operating expenses, then basically I actually paid a bunch of money for this labor at this facility, and now I want I not only want those expenses back, but I actually want to be paid interest on the money that I paid for labor.
That's right. And it's very important because if you borrow $100, if you have 10 years, $10 a year carrying costs, and you go 5 years, you're out of pocket. Your original $100 million, $100, which you spent, plus $50. Real money.
But I'm already asking for, I'm already asking for reasonable return on the $100 I invested. That's different.
Here is the key, I think. None of this is in the rate base. We're not getting any money on any of it. We're booking it. This AFUDC is the carrying cost. We're booking the $10 a year on the $100. So that we can later recover it. Nobody disputes that we have a right to do this. What happened here is that the commission created this gap, said we want to look at your historical operations. So we keep doing here exactly, and they admitted the same, exactly what we were doing over here. We're booking those carrying costs. But again, we're not getting a dime. We haven't gotten a dime back on these plants. That comes in the rate case. But, Your Honor, if we had a system where you borrow $100 and you don't get the interest on it for extended periods of time and you lose large amounts of money, it would be confiscatory. I suspect unconstitutional if we did it on purpose. And clearly unwise regulation. May I respectfully request, Your Honor, that my colleagues be given back the excessive time I should have.
Your time spent in answering questions. There'll be 20 minutes left for the remaining.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you just one more. If this is so essential then to providing service, do all of the major utilities in Texas that have been involved with these
large plants, say, for example, like Texas Utilities, do they use this kind of treatment?
Your Honor, I can't speak as to the entire universe of utilities. It may be that one of my colleagues can. These cases are somewhat peculiar, and I think it was because perhaps as Justice Hightower indicated, they were nuclear plants, they were new, they utilized what was called the big Cajun rule, where the commission would not let you time your rate case to avoid this regulatory gap that said you must operate them, then file it. So in every utility which came under this approach and was not allowed to time its rate case to begin recovering these costs, this problem would arise. I understand the commission is not now uniformly using this big Cajun rule where there's no adjustment back after the historical test year. So I don't know how often this problem will arise in the future. The commission may find it necessary to utilize it again in its discretion. But key thing is here, these utilities suffer the potential of hundreds of millions in devastating losses that cannot be justified on any legitimate economic or theoretical basis.
Once deferred accounting treatment is allowed, can the PUC disallow exclusion of those costs in the rate base solely on the grounds that they could have been paid out of cost savings in the past?
No. I think not, Your Honor. I don't know that that's an issue that Your Honor must face in this case today, but I would say not.
I think that to be the core issue in the, at least in the 679 case, the next case.
And what you get into there is, do we have retroactive rate making in this state? I think that this court has said no, that when you have an approved and final rate, the utility takes its chances under that rate. I mean, it may under-earn or it may be profitable. Frankly, in an inflationary economy, the utility is under constant pressure, as Your Honor knows. But you don't get to go back every time there's a new investment and say we're going to look back 5 or 10 years and see what your earnings were, and then we'll decide what we're going to allow and offset them against that. So I would say that would not be a legitimate issue. The issue would be on this plant, are those costs appropriate and proper? Of course, in the rate case, if they decide that the utility is earning too much on other assets, they could lower their rate of return or do what is done to deal with excessive earnings.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. I'd like to start by going back to a question that Justice Doggett asked a little bit earlier, and I hope that I might be able to answer it to your satisfaction, Your Honor. You asked, how do we know that a utility that's allowed to defer these kinds of costs can't absorb them in any other way? And the answer to that, I believe, is that in the dockets in which deferred accounting is considered, the commission looks at financial indicators. It looks at evidence as to what utility's financial situation would be with or without a deferral order.
But in looking at it, hasn't it applied a much lesser, a much more modest standard than that required for construction work in progress?
I don't know that it is a lesser standard. The standard the commission has applied in most of these cases is threat to financial integrity. And threat to financial integrity is the commission looks at whether the utility will have access to capital on reasonable terms. Now, with QIP, it's true that's usually looked at in terms of whether there's cash to pay the bills. But nonetheless, if a utility does not have access to capital on reasonable terms, that is a very real detriment to the utility. It's also a very real detriment to the consumers.
Isn't the question of whether it is a detriment to the utility, that really gets to the heart of my question, because as I've read the briefs on this issue, it seemed to me that the standard that the commission was applying was, will it have an effect on the utility? Anytime a utility spends several hundred million dollars, I'm sure it will have an effect on the utility, But that's not the standard that the legislature prescribed in the statute for construction work in progress. And it appears to me that this is perhaps only a way to include in the rate base something that is a much lesser standard than what the legislature prescribed.
Well, first of all, the deferral period does not coincide with the period for construction work in progress. So to the extent that the legislature has provided a remedy before a plant goes in service, I don't think that's indicative of what should be required for deferred accounting. And secondly, this is a very real detriment, and as I was saying, the harm ultimately is borne by the consumers, because if the utility is forced to pay higher costs of capital, that's going to be ultimately passed on to the consumers through that component of rates. So this is a way that the Commission has found to balance interests of consumers and utilities and to fulfill its statutory obligation.
If this is so essential to both the utilities and the consumers, how was this problem developed or handled before the use of deferred accounting treatment?
The problem was never this major before. And it's very true that there is regulatory lag inherent in the process of regulating utilities. In the past, most regulatory lag has just been allowed to happen and let the chips fall where they may. Sometimes it may work for the benefit of consumers, sometimes for the benefit of utilities, and it probably all comes out of the wash. But in these cases, we were talking about, in I believe all of these cases, a plant that was so significant, such a large portion of this utility's capital, that to not allow the utility to recover these expenses, these major new expenses, is more than just... an inconvenience or a slight difficulty that can be written off as regulatory lag.
Are there utilities that have large capital expenditure programs on nuclear power plants or other plants that are not using deferred accounting treatment?
There are. Some time back, and I'm sorry, I can't say exactly when, the Commission did away with what's known as the Big Cajun Rule that made this lag period, lengthen this lag period to some extent. I think that has made it easier for utilities to time their rate cases so that they can, as closely as possible, make the effective date of the new rate coincide with when the plant goes in service.
So why is that not a remedy to this problem?
Well, it's not a remedy to the problem that in the past that has already occurred. At the time that these cases arose, the cases that are before the court today, that was not true. At the time these cases arose, there was in place a commission policy that required the utilities to wait until they'd had the plant in service in a calendar quarter that was part of the historical test year. This created about a three-month delay, followed by, in most cases, at least a nine-month delay in finally getting an order.
So is the abolition of that commission policy provided an alternative remedy to the use of deferred accounting treatment?
It provided a remedy that might take care of the problem in most cases. I don't think that means that the Commission doesn't have authority to use deferred accounting in other situations as it sees fit. And this really is just a matter, I believe, of Commission discretion. It's a question of statutory authority. That's the question that is raised by the Court of Appeals opinion. And
why is it a discretionary matter when the expenses are the same in one case as they are in another case, and you allow deferred accounting in one case and you don't in another?
I don't know that we have a situation where the expenses have been the same in two different cases.
The type of expenses.
The type of expenses are the same, but the Commission exercises its discretion in deciding whether the lag period is so great and the expenses so extreme that something ought to be done about it. Now, Mr. Reisner has said that he thinks that a confiscation problem could arise, and I think that's true. There could certainly be cases where the lag is so extreme that it truly, clearly amounts to confiscation, and that is one basis for finding the Commission's authority to do this.
Is the deferral accounting, I mean, can the Commission go in after this deferral accounting is permitted and say these expenses were incurred within the first 3 months. We don't think that's a significant lag period, so that won't be included in the rate base without a determination of reasonable and prudent. I mean, once they determine the capital that deferred treatment is available for these expenses, how does the commission retain some sort of ability to go back and pick and choose what came as a result of extraordinary lag, what was the result of extraordinary expenses, or are all the expenses permitted to be included in it? One of the problems is once they've allowed deferred treatment, when you get to the rate making case, well, we said it's capitalized, so this is all part of the rate base. How do you pick and choose what's permitted and what's not?
The way the commission has applied deferred accounting to date is to only look in the rate case at whether the expenses were prudent, whether they're reasonable and necessary, and whether they're related to plans that are used and useful. If that is true, the commission's practice has been to permit the inclusion of those deferred cost assets in the rate base. There might be a res judicata problem with going back once the commission has made a finding that if you don't allow the deferral order to take place, you're going to have a threat to financial integrity, or the utility is going to suffer some kind of measurable harm. I think there might be a problem with going back in a later case and saying we were wrong on that finding and we'd like to undo that.
So once you've done it on one of what has been referred to as just a preliminary accounting procedure, it's over with for all intents and purposes?
I don't think it's not over with in terms of what gets included in.
Well, you suggested that determination may even be res judicata to the commission to ever looking at it again.
I think the determination of whether the utility's financial integrity is going to be threatened in the absence of a deferral order is something that's been decided and probably can't be reviewed.
So you allow then, at the time you consider deferred accounting treatment, a full and complete hearing for anyone who wants to present evidence that it does not threaten financial integrity to come forward and require the utility to show that it does.
That is correct. And in these cases, the interveners, Office of Public Utility Counsel, the General Counsel, the city, have been involved and have presented their own evidence for the Commission's consideration.
They argue that they never got to present evidence and argument that the utility could have funded these costs out of past savings. What's the response to that?
Well, I think it's true that the Commission has limited in these cases to some extent what kind of evidence it's allowed the parties to present. But the question of where the funds come from, I believe, is addressed in the evidence that the utility has presented. I'd have to look explicitly at each of those cases, but I believe that in each of them, the commission has found that the...
Do you agree they should get the litigation finished?
I think in this limited area, what the commission did was a proper exercise of its discretion. I think it reasonably decided that this should be a limited scope hearing, that it was not rate making, that there would be a later opportunity to allow those expenses in rate base only to the extent that they were reasonable and necessary and prudently incurred, and in the context of a rate case where all of the utility's expenses were going to be reviewed.
How do you, to permit deferred accounting, how do you reach the question of financial concern, the financial stability of the company? How do you reach that decision to allow deferred accounting without having a discussion or hearing on savings versus expenses at the time it's going on? I mean,
well, what the commission did in these cases was to look at the utility status, that is, what the utility was actually earning at the time of the deferral order, and compare that to what would happen in the absence of deferred accounting. So at that point, if the utility were over-earning, I think it would become clear because of that kind of evidence.
So there,
it's a comparison.
You're looking at the net income of the utility when you're determining if these expenses are so disproportionate that it would affect financial stability.
That's correct.
Is Texas Utilities a company that has a large construction program that does not use deferred concrete?
I believe that's correct. I don't believe that the Texas Utilities has ever asked for deferred accounting.
Is the commission's view of this just searching for a practical solution to the regulatory lag problem when you have big costs? Is that?
That's absolutely right. As I said, I think regulatory lag is inherent in the process. That's not to say that it shouldn't be corrected if it can. And this is an exercise of commission discretion to address that problem. It is a reasonable exercise. There's, as our briefs, I think, clearly state, there's ample statutory authority for this. It does not contradict the statute, as Mr. Herron will address in a little bit more detail. And that kind of determination should not be subject to second-guessing by a court.
Is the scheme unique to our Texas statute and our Texas experience, or can we look to any experiences of any other states with comparable regulatory problems?
I believe Mr. Herron can probably answer this in more detail, but it certainly is true that other jurisdictions, including FERC and other state jurisdictions, do permit deferred accounting in cases like this as well as in other cases, for instance, maybe for storm damage, another unusual expense that is not contemplated in the rates.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Please support Bob Herron for HLT. Hope I have about 10 minutes left, and I'll try to use that expeditiously. In HLNP's case, certainly, and I believe in CPL also, the totality of the utility's revenues were considered. So any issue of over-earning would have, or savings to ratepayers, was taken into account in deciding whether there was a need for deferred accounting. I think that's something that overlooked.
The totality of the financial situation, not just the...
That's right. These evidence was presented of financial indicators showing, based on the utility's current situation, if there had been savings that ratepayers weren't getting the benefit of, those would have been displayed by the financial indicators. So the finding of need for financial integrity is based on the reality of the situation. We've got 41 up there, and that's what I was going to talk about. But let me talk about 39 first, because 39 is something Ms. Goggin didn't have an opportunity to spend enough time on. That is the core provision of PURA. That says that in fixing the rates, a utility is entitled to earn a reasonable return. That is a paraphrase in many respects of the constitutional requirement to the same effect. That is really what controls this case. As Mr. Reisner pointed out, if you have this enormous gap that can be so large, either because the time is so long or the amounts are so tremendous, that 39 in the Constitution could be infringed. But what I'd like to explain is how on earth the Court of Appeals, in the face of all of this, found that deferred accounting for carrying costs somehow was illegal. And that gets us to 41, and particularly 41A. It's interesting that petitioners don't really defend the Court of Appeals analysis in so many terms, at least I haven't heard it yet. But we are dealing here with a Court of Appeals opinion, which is clearly erroneous in focusing on this last sentence of Section 41A. Now, 41A is a supplementary provision. It simply sets out some rules for determining what ought to go into invested capital. First, it says that the rates are based upon the original cost of property. And as the court knows, historically, there's been a lot of argument about that. Since 83, rates in Texas are based on cost, not appraised value or reproduction cost or whatever. Secondly, it recognizes that there can be costs that are incurred during the construction phase.
in the first sentence says, including construction work in progress at cost. It doesn't define construction work in progress. The statute could be broad enough to include all the construction, including that after some technical commercial operation date. As the Mr. Reeser pointed out, the problem is presented simply by accounting rules that say when you get the commercial operation date, quit recording stops. The last sentence here is where the Court of Appeals went wrong. The last sentence is an anti-flip provision. It says that one utility can't build a plant for $100 million and then sell it to a second utility and let the second utility pay $200 million and then say, well, our cost was $200 million. It says, no, you go back to the original cost, the actual money cost, at the time it shall have been dedicated to public use, whether by the present owner or by a predecessor. That's the only purpose of that sentence. The Ohio Supreme Court Justice Hightower has construed a similar Ohio statute exactly as we're asking this court to construe 41A, as simply a valuation statute, not as a limitation on inclusion of costs in invested capital. The Court of Appeals found somehow that this last sentence was a limit, and once you got to the commercial operation date, that any other costs had to be excluded. And they did that by saying that dedicated to public use means the same thing as commercial operation date. Well, commercial operation date is not defined in the statute. That's simply an accounting term.
Historically, hasn't that what dedicated to public use has always meant in utility law long before the enactment of the Public Utilities Regulatory Act?
And dedicated to public use has long been considered to be when the money is spent. Obviously, for construction work, that controls construction costs. After a CCN, the Commission authorizes the construction. Those expenditures are then dedicated to public use as they're made. And there is no limitation which would exclude expenditures after the commercial operation date. That the Court of Appeals simply was wrong. They got off on the wrong track on that. And unfortunately, in the opinion on rehearing, they then tried to draw some distinction between operating costs and carrying costs, which doesn't hold water either. Because I think, as Mr. Reasoner has pointed out, the carrying costs are no more construction costs than the operating costs after the commercial operation date, if you want to look solely at construction costs, but they're real costs. And if you don't recover those carrying costs, then in effect you have lent your money, the utility investor has, for the benefit of utility service over a period of years without the opportunity for recovering a return. Basically, what we have here, if it pleases the court, is a simple fact that a utility can't be forced to conduct and operate a plant, to construct and operate a plant without an opportunity for recovery of the cost. And any rate structure that would do that without, if I may just continue
for a moment, finish your thought.
Would do that violates not only 39A, but the constitutional prohibitions against confiscation. In CP&L's case and in HL&P's case, and I believe in El Paso's case, the situations we have here, this commission found that a failure to allow reporting and deferral of these costs would impair these utilities' financial integrity. That I don't think that finding can be seriously challenged. The exclusion was based upon simply a misreading of 41A, and we ask that the court in this case affirm the commission's orders in CPL, HL&P, and El Paso on this deferred accounting issue, and incidentally affirm the decision of the district court doing so as well.
What if the CUC determined that
some portion of the total cost could be expensed. That the utility could stand expensing some of the cost, but not all of it. Could it allow a deferred accounting for some of the cost?
Perhaps in some future case that could be done, Justice Heck. I think we need to realize that this is a real case that happened in real time before this commission, and the evidence in this case is that none of these costs could be deferred without impairing financial integrity. I think Justice Douglas' question at the beginning of the argument sets the proper tone. How could investors be encouraged to invest in a utility, lend money, buy its bonds, if the commission regulating it says there are times, significant periods of time, when under Texas law you can't recover for that investment?
It seems a little incredulous that $1 could push it over the edge, but certainly $270 million might. Wouldn't the commission be expected to determine where in there the problem lies?
I think the commission certainly has that opportunity, Your Honor. I think the problem I'm having with your question is that it speaks of a hypothetical case, while in this case, for HL&P, the amount involved for STP Unit 1 was in excess of $600 million. HL&P could not take a $600 million hit. And the commission didn't have before it whether, well, can you take 50 or 100? The commission found you can't take 600.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Gardner, do you agree with Mr. McCullough that Section 41A does not prohibit the use of deferred accounting?
Your Honor, our argument is that Section 41A, in fact, does prohibit, doesn't allow, and therefore the use of deferred accounting is prohibited.
So you and the Attorney General are split on that issue?
We have a different view of it, yes, Your Honor. And let me explain my view, if I may, for just a minute, because that is one of the things that I wanted to do in this rebuttal. And that is, when you look at Section 39A talks about a reasonable return, actually talks about a reasonable opportunity to earn a reasonable return on invested capital. But pure Section 39A does not define what invested capital is. So the only way you can determine, the only way the court or the commission or anyone else can determine what is in invested capital is to look at what's in Section 41. And the Section 41 definition of invested capital talks about original cost, and it does get it, and we believe, and we didn't get an opportunity in our opening, but I think we've said it in our briefs, we believe that the Court of Appeals construction of Section 41A and the time requirement was correct insofar as the Court of Appeals went. That is, that the last sentence, which defines original cost, does indeed define original cost of the plant at the time dedicated to public use. And I disagree with counsel when counsel says that the money is dedicated to public use when it's spent. The money, the plant is dedicated to public use at the time that the plant is used and useful. And we cannot forget, Your Honor, the portions of the statute that talk about the plant needing to be used and useful in order to be entitled to be considered invested capital.
And that's a principle that predates the PURA, is it, in utility law in Texas, that you ask people to pay for utility plant when they can use it as an incentive to get that plant online?
Yeah, Your Honor, I quite frankly can't go back to the prior statutes. It's certainly true in the cases and in the discussion of in the earlier cases where the used and useful standard is discussed, that it goes back to some early Supreme Court cases in the 1930s. Although also, in honesty, some of those cases also are talking about the difference between original cost and fair value rate making.
Counsel, you said at the outset that we have not identified a double recovery, and so based on what you just said in that earlier statement, is it your contention that the utilities must eat this cost?
There is some degree of potential double recovery, and I don't know that we have brought it forward in the case, but it's certainly true that for El Paso Electric, for example, that they had construction work in progress in rate base for the rates that were set for them in January of 1986, this case called Docket 6350. And at the same time, they had the rates collecting for construction work in progress. They were also accumulating accounting deferrals once Palo Verde Unit 1 went commercial. And that is, the rates were decided in January of 1986, including construction work in progress and rate base, some amount, not all, but some amount. And then in March of 1986, when Unit 1 went commercial, they started accumulating these accounting deferrals. And so to the extent that these accounting deferrals involve the same thing, return as the amount of construction work in progress and rate base, there is some degree of double recovery. But that, the point is, the more important point, Your Honor, is that that's why the statute contemplates these remedies for regulatory lag when you have financial integrity problems, such as construction work in progress and rate base. And what happened was El Paso Electric had a financial integrity problem that was resolved by the commission, at least on the basis of the test year and looking at the financial integrity standard and dealing with the construction work in progress issue. We'd also want to point out, I need to point out before I run out of time, and I don't know exactly when that is, but I need to point out that all of this discussion about financial integrity does not apply to the Palo Verde Unit 2 case, which is involved in our appeal, because the commission entered no findings that the accounting deferrals were necessary for Palo Verde Unit 2. The only discussion is found in the examiner's report, where the examiners apparently concluded that the measurable harm standard, something I think you'll hear about when you hear the West Texas Utilities case in a little while, that there was some measurable harm, but that there was not a financial integrity problem. That is, that El Paso Electric did not need these accounting deferrals for its financial integrity for Palo Verde Unit number 2. So we want you to bear in mind that although there were some findings regarding HLNP, those findings don't exist for El Paso Electric.
Mr. Gordon, how does your focus on rate base and invested capital deal with deferred maintenance on a facility? If the only invested capital that can be included in the rate base is the original cost of the unit, how do you handle capitalized expenses? I've got to invest, I don't know, $100 million to replace a generator or a burner or a boiler or whatever I've got to do if my rate base can only be calculated on the property cost at the time that the property was dedicated. How do you handle that kind of...
Well, I see two different circumstances. One is the circumstance in which you need to have what is often called capital additions to a plant that's already been built. And that is that your generator may need to be replaced. These are items other than normal maintenance items that you would contemplate setting rates, and that's where the division is. If it is truly a capital expenditure, then you have a new cost of that plant because you have new plant that you have put in. You have expanded the cost. And the commission has never decided that the cost of the plant, once the plant has changed and you have a new plant for a different plant, is related back to the date the plant went into commercial operation. If, on the other hand, we're talking about something that would be in the form of some extraordinary maintenance that wouldn't normally be capitalized, that situation is taken care of in the normal accounting for expenses and revenues. It's an expenditure that happens in the test year, then you deal with it appropriately and arrive at a representative value. And that's what the commission's always tried to do. So that's where I draw the line.
I thought in order to get part of the rate base, if it's going to be included in the rate base, the expenditure has to be something that's a reoccurring thing. If it's not a reoccurring thing, then it wouldn't be a part of the rate base calculation.
And
I mean, if I've got one major expense here, that doesn't necessarily change rates in the future.
And what commissions do in trying to look at recurring, usually non-recurring expenses might not be allowed, but in looking at extraordinary expenses, expenses that don't necessarily come every year but come with some regularity or some predictability, commissions try to arrive at a representative value, a representative amount for those expenses, so that if if you have this expense every 3 years, then you might have one-third of it included in to arrive at a representative value. And that's the way that problem is dealt with.
Any other questions?
Thank you. If
it's good enough for FERC and it's good enough for Ohio, why isn't it good enough for Texas?
Our statute is different, Your Honor. And our argument is based on the statute. Plus, the Ohio statute is also different. The Ohio statute doesn't have the words, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, as counsel did not point out, the Ohio statute does not have the words at the time dedicated to public use in its statute. And that's the distinction the Court of Appeals drew from the Ohio Supreme Court decision. That's why we think it's appropriate.
What about with reference to FERC?
FERC also operates under a different statute. FERC doesn't have a statute that defines rate base the same way that the Texas legislature has defined invested capital for Texas.
So if the Texas legislature wanted to change the statute to permit this approach, you're not saying it couldn't do that. It just has not.
It has not, Your Honor. That's correct.
Any other questions? Thank you. Okay. We'll give Mr. McCullough 5 minutes.
Mr. McCullough, we seem to have some disagreement on the effect of allowing the deferred accounting. Now, there's been this straight-up statement that when the argument on rate gets before the PUC, they will be arguing about the reasonableness of these expenses and the use and usefulness of the expenses. And if the utility doesn't prove that, it won't be included in the rate base, irrespective of having been deferred. Do you disagree?
The commission order says deferred costs will be included in invested capital to the extent the commission finds them to be prudent, reasonable, and necessary.
So at some point in the future, you bring your guns out and you're going to argue that any of these expenses that they want to include in the rate base better be reasonable and prudent and used and useful.
We would have the opportunity to show that they were imprudent or unreasonable or necessary. We would not have the opportunity to say too much was deferred in order to maintain the company's financial integrity during a regulatory lag period. You didn't need the entire deferral amount. That's the important difference. Yes, we can contest whether it was reasonable to spend the dollar. What we cannot contest is whether it was reasonable for them to get it to begin with in order to maintain financial integrity. They got every cent, regardless of whether half of it, a fourth of it, or three quarters of it was necessary to maintain financial integrity.
And your position is that the commission precluded you from arguing about that in the earlier proceeding?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. Let me indicate a couple of things that we were precluded from inquiring into. Affiliate transactions, prudence, reasonableness and necessary, the very test under 41A for QIP. In fact, the utilities mentioned that they could not pass the financial integrity test under QIP, the one that the legislature had just changed.
How did they do that?
The financial integrity test used by the commission was quite different than the one required by the new 41A. In fact, the commission test for this was the one that the legislature was so dissatisfied with when it changed 41A.
I guess my question is, how did the utilities indicate they could not meet the section 41A test?
First of all, 41A requires a showing of prudence, and they didn't want to litigate prudence in these deferred accounting cases. Second, the financial integrity test was merely looking at financial indicators as governed by whether they met certain coverage criteria. And let me mention HLMP and CPO for that matter. The commission found that deferred accounting for CPO would improve its financial integrity. In Docket 9010, the Unit 1 deferred accounting extension case, the evidence was absolutely clear that even without an extension of deferred accounting, the company still met its minimum coverage ratios. So this financial integrity test ultimately ended up being just a test of low financial ratios, not whether they would have access to the market on reasonable terms. Let me mention FERC for a second, if I can, because this is an important thing. You've heard time and time again that FERC allows deferred accounting. First of all, FERC is the one that establishes the accounting rules, and it had to come up with some method to provide for accounting of when states allow deferred accounting, and there are states that have granted it, some that have disallowed it. But it's important to remember that the return component of state-allowed deferred accounting is put in FERC account 402, acquisition adjustment, the rate-based inflation by when a subsequent purchaser buys a plant at higher than original cost. It's clear that Texas does not allow acquisition adjustments in rate base, and that's where FERC puts the carrying cost on deferred accounting. FERC does not allow a carrying cost on deferred accounting in the interstate jurisdiction. It has ruled that deferred accounting would violate the original cost theory in the interstate jurisdiction. Mr. Herron said 39 is the key to this case. Why then did the commission continually forswear Article 39? We're not acting under 39. We're not acting under 41. We're acting under 27, our accounting rules. Why did it grant a return under 41 when it wasn't even using 41?
What is the significance of that?
Well, first of all, the commission insisted this was not a rate-making case. How can it grant a rate return in a non-rate-making case? The commission found that the utilities have no constitutional right to deferred accounting. The denial of it would not be confiscation. The significance is the so-called key to the case, Section 39, was not the one that the commission used.
But you agree that it could be confiscation.
At some point, yes, unreasonably low rates in the face of extreme regulatory lag can become confiscation, but we never reached that point.
Any other questions? Did the council have 5 full minutes? Any other questions? That concludes the arguments in the first of 3 consolidated clauses. The court will now take a brief recess.